Thank you, Laura. This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center. The TV lights are on. The camera crews from, I think, ABC and CBS are here set up in the ballroom A and B of the Valdez Civic Center, and we're expecting in moments for the official press conference to start. However, until while they are getting the last few lights set up and people are filing in, we'll take a moment. Mayor John Devens is with me. John, I understand the City Council just had a special meeting called to deal with this situation. Would you care to share with us what the outcome of that meeting was?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We met this evening to determine whether or not we could appropriate some of the funding from the Zone 3 to take care of any of the problems that the city might encounter. And we did budget $1 million of the money that's in the Zone 3 account and actually appropriated $100,000 of that for a pit for the storage of absorbent materials.
The situation has been difficult to ascertain during the course of the day. We've had statements from various agencies, but very little input or feedback from people who have actually seen the situation. Were there any late reports given to the council at the meeting that you just had?
No, actually, there was quite a few questions. We had quite a number of people in the audience, all frustrated because of lack of knowledge, feeling as though the city was not included in some of the decision-making processes enough. And that was actually something that was echoed by the members of the City Council. We're hoping to get one of our city administrators involved in the EOC and be involved in some of the decision-making, since this is impacting the city.
EOC is the Emergency Operations Center?
Yes, that's correct.
Recently, we of course have had two oil spill incidents within the port itself, plus in the last 6 months there's been a major emergency response drill done by LASCA, in which there were procedures for community involvement, information, and whatnot. Is your observation at this point that those drill procedures are being followed, or when the real thing came, did everybody run around in circles?
You know, I don't really know enough to make an honest comment on it. I know there were lots of concerns expressed about why 16 hours after the event took place didn't we have booms out there, but I really don't know enough to know whether or not they did what they should have done or didn't.
I know the governor's in town. Has he had a chance to meet with city government officials to this point?
Bob Keller and I met with the governor for probably 20 minutes or so this afternoon when he came in. He wasn't here very long and then went immediately out to the site and has been out there since, or gone home, I don't know which.
I understand he's still in town and holding a press conference at the airport before he leaves, so we'll all scramble from here out to there. You're listening to KCHU Radio. I'm Dave Hammack. I'm at the Valdez Civic Center. There is a special press conference been called here, I suppose called by Exxon, the company that owns both the tanker and the oil that is involved in the spill incident in Prince William Sound. At this hour, no fresh news on what is happening at the site itself. We hope to have an explanation of the current status, as well as perhaps some discussion of how this all came to happen in a few minutes when the press conference is underway. I understand the president of Exxon Shipping is supposed to be here for this.
Yes, that is correct. He should be in town right now.
All right, well, Mayor John Devens, thank you for taking a moment and talking with us. We'll go back to the studio in just a moment. We'll be standing by here until the event does start. Again, we're expecting representatives from Exxon, the owner of the Exxon Valdez and the oil involved in the spill. And there'll be questions from both local and statewide and national press members who are here. We're going to find out how good the audio lash-up is here, whether we hear the questions. We'll certainly hear the answers, and that'll all be starting here pretty quick. For the time being, this is Dave Hammack signing off at the Civic Center. Back to you, Laura.
On behalf of Exxon, I wish to express our regrets for the any anxiety or inconvenience caused as a result of the grounding of Exxon Valdez. I want to also assure all of you that Exxon is mobilizing all of the resources available to mitigate the impact from this incident. And I'll talk a little bit about what is going on and how we plan to approach this in a minute. I also want to clearly state that Exxon has assumed full financial responsibility for the cleanup or anything that needs to go on. And as soon as we can get our response team operational, we plan also to assume operational responsibility for the salvage and cleanup. Thanks to the very rapid response of the U.S. Coast Guard, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and Alyeska's response teams, I think the first steps in corralling or controlling this incident have already been initiated. And I'd like to thank those agencies for moving as quickly as they did. Right now, we have two very important objectives, and the first one is to move aggressively to collect or disperse the oil that is on the water. And time is critical, so we're moving very quickly to get the resources in place to undertake that activity. At the same time, we're moving cautiously to remove the oil from the damaged vessel and to salvage the vessel. Safety is paramount in this particular regard. We need to move cautiously and carefully because the last thing in the world we want is any more oil in the water. So we need to move aggressively to attack the oil that is on the water, and we need to move cautiously and carefully to get the rest of the oil off of the damaged ship. And I'll be talking about that also. Once we have eliminated the danger to the environment and to the vessel, then we will need to reconstruct the events that led up to the incident so we can understand exactly what went on and why the vessel grounded. I'm sure all of you have those questions too. We'll be initiating our own investigation, and I'm sure the Coast Guard will be initiating its investigation. The current condition of the vessel, as far as we know, let me just step back and say the vessel is a 211,000-ton tanker. It's a U.S. flag tanker with a U.S. crew. Its construction was completed in December of 1986. It is therefore one of the newest vessels in the U.S. tanker fleet. For the past 2 years since her delivery, she has been in Valdez service. The master is Captain Joseph Hazelwood. He's a veteran with 20 years experience in the Exxon fleet. He's been a master for over 10 years, and he's been the master of Exxon Valdez for the past 20 months. He also has unlimited pilotage qualification for Prince William Sound. The vessel is still aground on Bligh Reef, and we just came in from Houston and got an opportunity to fly over the vessel. As far as we know, five cargo tanks are clearly damaged, damaged during grounding. There is some reason to believe that perhaps three other cargo tanks are damaged. The vessel itself is fully operational. She has full power available. All of her systems are operational. She has full steering control. An estimated 200,000 barrels of crude oil escaped from the vessel. Most of it escaped at the time of the grounding or shortly after the grounding. The oil slick now covers approximately 6 square miles, and we flew over that also. It's drifting southward slowly in Prince William Sound, and they understand that some oil has been detected ashore. Alyeska has three skimming boats and two tank barges in operation collecting oil from the slick. There are three tugs assisting the vessel. We have one tanker in the vicinity. It's the Exxon Baton Rouge, which is a 75,000-ton tanker. Our plan is to move the Baton Rouge alongside the Valdez once we are sure that we understand the condition of the damaged vessel. And are confident, once we are confident that we can do that, we will move the Baton Rouge alongside and begin to lighter the cargo from the damaged vessel onto the Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge could take about 450,000 barrels, or about half the remaining oil on the ship. The Exxon San Francisco, also a 75,000 tonner, will be arriving at sunrise tomorrow. And our plan would be to lighter the remaining cargo from the damaged vessel onto the Exxon San Francisco. We also have had offers from ARCO, from Chevron, and from BP. All of them have vessels in the vicinity, and they are all more than anxious to help us lighter the cargo off of the vessel. The nucleus of the response team arrived just within the past hour. Six of us came in from Houston and three from San Francisco. Together, these nine people will essentially manage the casualty response efforts. We also have a group of 20 members of Exxon's response team on the way, and they'll be coming in later tonight and early this morning. Altogether, we have 20 members of this response team. That's in addition to the nine that are already here. And these 20 people are trained in different aspects of casualty response, and they will essentially be the supervisors of different activities that are going on. They are well trained. They all know what they have to do. In fact, their last training exercise was a two-day training exercise in October of 1988. So these folks are well qualified for what they need to do. We are also assembling about three-quarters of the world's experts on oil spill cleanup. Mr. Gordon Lindblom came up with us from Houston. He's an expert on dispersant application. Mr. Jim O'Brien is on his way here. He's an expert on mechanical cleanup. He's the gentleman, incidentally, who took over the cleanup of the Glacier Bay. He also recently was in Antarctica helping with the cleanup from that vessel that ran aground in Antarctica. Mr. Al Allen is also joining our group. He is an expert on Alaskan oil spill cleanup, and he will be part of the team. Coming in from San Francisco is Mr. Jim Rivera. He's bringing two assistants with him. He heads the Clean Bay Cooperative in San Francisco, and he's bringing his equipment with him. Mr. Brent Pyburn is coming in from London. He's bringing four of his assistants with him. And he is a representative of the Oil Spill Response Limited group there. Also, Alice Berkner has been asked to join the group, and she is with International Bird Rescue Center in case we need that. The cleanup crew members are being assembled. Our first available people are the Alyeska offshift people, and we hope to have 50 to 60 members from that group, and I understand they have had recent experience here at the terminal. We also have 40 members of cleanup crews coming over from Kenai, and we anticipate that we'll be able to mobilize another 150 if we need it, and we're in the process of getting in touch with those people. So altogether, we have about 40 managers, supervisors, and experts from all over the U.S. and also from the United Kingdom. We have about 100 members available to form cleanup crews, and we're hoping to mobilize another 150 if needed. We also have set up a claims management team, and we have an Exxon claims coordinator on the scene. He came up from Houston with us, and we all have also enlisted the help of Crawford and Company to handle any claims resulting from the incident. Let me talk about equipment, and we're mobilizing a lot of it. We have a DC-8 cargo jet coming in from San Francisco. It is either going to arrive, maybe here now, but it was due in late this afternoon or early evening. It is carrying the Clean Bay equipment, which is one ocean oil skimming system and a whole system of emergency communications, because as we get this operation going, we're going to need to keep in touch with all the different parties. We also have a C-130 dispersant spray plane, which is coming in from Florida. It should arrive. Its last ETA we heard was 6 o'clock in the morning. We also have a 707 cargo jet coming in from London. That's bringing the equipment that Mr. Pyburn and his assistants will need. They have 4 oil skimming units that will be coming in on this plane, including portable oil containment tanks. And that plane is due to arrive in Saturday morning. We have a second C-130 spray plane coming in from Houston, and we expect that to be here late Saturday. We have a 707 cargo jet coming in from Houston. It's loading the second supply of dispersant. There is about 400 drums of dispersant available to us between Anchorage and here in Alaska. That'll be our first supply, and then we'll need to be resupplying from Houston, and this 707 will be shuttling back and forth. We have another cargo aircraft, I don't know the type, it's coming in from Seattle, and it's bringing 2,500 feet of boom. Also, there's some boom coming in from Kenai. That plane is due to arrive late Saturday morning. So altogether, we've got at least 6 aircraft en route with different types of skimming equipment and also dispersants. In addition, we have all of the equipment available to Alyeska. They have 3 oil skimming vessels, and we saw those vessels out in the Prince William Sound. We have the 2 Exxon vessels available, and we also have a number of vessels that have been offered into us to assist from ARCO, Chevron, and BP. Our plan at this point will be to begin the lightering operations once we are convinced that we can do that safely. And our concern is for the damaged condition of the Valdez. We have to make sure that that vessel is up to this type of operation and we can remove the cargo safely. So we're going to do that very carefully, but the Baton Rouge is in place and the San Francisco will be coming in, the Exxon San Francisco will be coming in first thing tomorrow morning to form a backup. We would like to be able to lighter all of the cargo off the vessel. When we're about halfway through that operation, the vessel will float free. We'll then try to continue the lightering in place, moving it to a safer position. We're right now developing alternatives to handle the oil that is on the water. It looked to us like it is spreading as it moves south, so we're going to need to move very quickly. And our first alternative will be to apply chemical dispersant to it starting in the morning. And we'll be moving to a full-scale operation once we determine the effectiveness of that first application. So just recapping, those of us in this business understand that once in a great while this happens to us. We look back in the records and the previous spill to any time this month for an Exxon ship goes all the way back to 1972 when we lost about 1,000 barrels from a vessel in Connecticut. So for the past 17 years, we haven't had an incident like this. And unfortunately, this is the second one we've handled this month. So we had 17 good years, but this has not been our best month. We are moving very, very quickly to get all the resources in place, and hopefully by first thing tomorrow morning, we'll be in full operation. Okay, at this point, I'm ready to address questions.
This is KCHU Valdez. We're broadcasting live from the Valdez Civic Center. You've been listening to Jack Rossi, president of the Exxon Shipping Company. We won't be able to hear the questions from the press. We'll be able to hear the responses, and we hope they'll recap the answers. Here's Jack Rossi.
And we've had very sketchy communications, and I haven't had time. I just dropped my bag, shaved my whiskers, and came over here. So it could be 300,000. I couldn't. Yes. We, at this stage, really don't understand the sequence of events. What we know is that the vessel proceeding out of the channel ahead of ours requested permission, and it was granted to move out of the outbound lane across the separation into the inbound lane in order to avoid some heavy ice that was on the blocking the outboard lane. We also understand our ship did the same thing and was granted permission to move over to the far edge of the vessel traffic lane. But the circumstances that transpired from that point to the grounding, we really do not understand ourselves. We have all the same questions you do. And we'll certainly be moving at the appropriate time to dig into all those questions. Right now, we are moving with almost single-mindedness to get that lightering operation going so that we can get the oil off. And then secondly, to begin to to address the oil that is on the water. When we get through all of that, and that's going to absorb all of our resource and energy for a short period of time here, when we get through with that, then we clearly are going to have to dig in, and we'll dig into all of the circumstances leading up to the incident. Yes?
My name is Ricky
Ott. Yes, Ricky.
United Fishermen of Alaska and the local fishing group, Fredona District Fishing United. I'm sorry this had to be your vote, but we were expecting something like this. At this point, I've expressed a lot of concerns about it, one.
Yes, certainly we all have concerns.
The first is, we were flying at 9 o'clock this morning. I believe we were the first plane up.
Ricky Ott of the Cordova Fisheries CDFU is now addressing some questions to Jack Rossi. And it's difficult to hear the questions. We will hear the responses. She's asking a question about 9 o'clock this morning. The first flyover was apparently by CDFU, and she's asking why there was no response evident at the time about 9 o'clock this morning.
It happened in the inside waters. There was no weather. It's flat calm. There's no wind. Also, the proximity to the tanker terminal in Alaska where the booming equipment was available, this boat should have been boomed immediately, or something should have been done immediately to contain the oil. At 12:30 when we were out up in the air again, I was amazed to see that the boat was still.
Well, the question is taking on more of the aspect of a statement. Ricky is asking why there was no effort evident at 9 o'clock on the first flyover or at 12:30 on a subsequent flyover. At 12:20, KCHU had one of its volunteers in an aircraft on the flyover, and at that time we also noted that at 12:30, approximately 12 hours after the incident did occur, there had been no evident effort toward booming the tanker or beginning a containment effort. Again, that question is being addressed in great detail to Jack Rossi by Ricky Ott of CDFU at this time. Again, this is a quick put-together on the audio, and we certainly apologize for not being able to carry these questions. We'll do our best to relay to you the gist of the question. We will be able to hear the response from Jack Rossi.
The first question I really can't address. I got here a half hour ago. I don't know if there's anybody in the room who can.
We need a name. I can get this from you later, but the fishermen would like to refer to being here on all One more major point in that this person's, as far as I know, not to be used in this area. I mean, they have to go through an on-scene coordinator.
Yes, all that's been done. This is a Zone 1 area. And that means that it's been predetermined that the decision-making process to use or not use dispersants rests with the Coast Guard.
However,
yeah, there must be 10 or 15 years of history in the use of dispersants, a lot of work that's been done with the Environmental Protection Agency, with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And certain areas are prejudged to be safer dispersants, and that authority rests usually with the local Coast Guard to make that decision. Other zones where it's more sensitive, then that judgment passes to others, higher authority. I don't know the particular circumstances here.
Dispersants are also most effective if they're used within 24 hours. They're very effective if they're used within 12 hours.
Yeah. I'm not the dispersants expert. We do have one with us. He told me, wait just a minute. His advice was that the dispersants wouldn't be effective immediately after the spill because the layer was too thick. You actually have to get some spreading, and you have to get, and again, I'm not talking as an expert, but you have to get some spreading, and you have to get a layer that's thin enough to be most effective. I think we got a great window tomorrow morning, and that's when we'll be working it.
There was, we could see the haze on the water of the hydrocarbons evaporating, the volatile hydrocarbons, which means that this stuff is rapidly turning into a very patty cake-like consistency stuff, which on which the dispersants will not be effective at all.
Well, I don't think we can prejudge that.
Are you taking examples prior to dispersant use?
I think the most effective will be a test. And when we run our first run tomorrow, then we'll be able to tell. I don't think anybody can prejudge at this point whether it's going to be effective or not.
So you can try a little patch first.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Edward, the fact was that it was about, 12, 14 hours before anybody saw anything out there that even remotely resembled a sort of containment measure. I'm Larry Campbell. I'm with the Anchorage Daily News. There is the question, and a lot of people have asked this, about why something more wasn't done earlier, why there wasn't somewhat more containment measures being undertaken at an earlier stage in time. How do you feel about it?
Well, the information I have, just let me go back to what I do know. The grounding occurred at 0038, which was about, let's call it 3:40 Houston time. And I was awoken at about 4:20 with a call from Alyeska. So they were immediately mobilizing. And we started working from there in Houston. And by about 6:30, Houston time, we were going full out. We had, as you can imagine, pulling all these planes and equipment in the air didn't just happen. And we were mobilizing by 6:30 in the morning, everything we can get our hands on. That's Houston time. So that would be about by 3:30 in the morning your time, or roughly 3 hours after the event. I don't know what activities were going on here, but I do know from the numerous conversations I had with George Nelson and also with the other Alyeska people. I mean, they were up and moving fast.
What were
you
doing?
I was in Houston.
Well, are you satisfied with what they've done up to the point that you got here?
I really have to dig in and find out exactly what was going on and what were the circumstances.
Well, right now, can you say, are you satisfied or do you still have questions?
I have a lot of questions.
If the question is, as quickly as you were able to move this morning, as much as you did, is there another place here that we have to fly equipment from London and San Francisco, an area that is not prepared?
Well, you know, it's not uncommon. I tell you, we had two spills in a matter of 3 weeks. The one previous was just about 3 weeks ago in Hawaii, and we did exactly the same thing. We had the same planes in the air. We were moving the same equipment. It's just a fact that the way the oil response system worldwide goes, there's a number of stockpiles. And what you really have to do is stockpile that equipment alongside a major airport, and a major airport that has a lot of traffic and a lot of cargo planes. Because while you could buy equipment and put it in a storehouse, you can't buy 707s and DC-8s and leave them there. So you got to have immediate access to cargo jets. So you find out that the equipment is stored near London, near Houston, near San Francisco, so that wherever a spill occurs, you can load it in the plane and get it in the air. And it's all packaged very quickly, palletized, to be moved onto a plane. So I think the key factor in where the oil industry and the response industry centers its activity is really related to major airports, because you do need a good logistics system. You need
a problem with the major shipping lines.
Well, you know, the major shipping lane starts in Valdez, but it goes all the way down to Panama. So, you know, we're in that spot. I can understand your sensitivity since you're in this part of the shipping lane. I'm not saying I wouldn't be as sensitive as you are, except when you look at it, the shipping lane goes, you know, thousands of miles, and you need to be ready to respond up and down that coast.
Given the critical time of all this, again, why doesn't the oil industry stockpile this stuff right here in Valdez, and how long has the terminal been here?
I think there is a fair amount of equipment. There's a lot of dispersant. There are 400 barrels of dispersant available, 400 drums right here and now. What we've got to do is get the spray plane here. The spray plane is coming all the way from Florida. But we had the same situation with the Hawaii spill. So one of the key things is that Alyeska does have a major supply of dispersant here. And there's still plenty of time to hit the spill. You know, we flew over it coming in. We were at 3,000 feet, so we didn't see the sea lions.
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to know. I didn't get your last name. What was it?
Fiorossa.
Yes, sir. I didn't hear you say anything about hiring Alaska help. All I hear you say, you're going to send it all in. Now, what are you going to do here? This disaster happened in our water.
I'm sure we'll be looking for all available help, to the extent.
What are you going to do about our herring out there? Did you come up with anything on that?
Well, I'm not an expert on herring, our herring, but certainly we're going to be very, very conscious of it.
Okay. That's what I want to know.
Yes, sir.
In response to some of the questions that response from Alyeska, there was people mobilized within, I'd say, an hour after the thing went aground here, as early as 1 o'clock in the morning. And they were on their way of doing a lot of preparatory work and things. But that brings to mind my question is, why haven't you and Alyeska made a permanent and storage area for such a collecting for oil spill emergencies? There hasn't been anything stockpiled here of any quantity that would take care of this major port. And it was inevitable that something of this magnitude would come about, and there should have been some stockpiling of this material.
I can understand your concern. But I think you're going to find that that airport out there is going to be inundated with equipment very soon. And that's the way that that response equipment is normally handled. So in just about any spill like this, you're going to have a period when you need to mobilize people, you need to mobilize the experts, and you need to get the equipment there. And I think in this case, we're going to have it all here and probably 24 hours or 30 hours. which still gives us plenty of time. We really haven't begun to dig into that. I think at this point, I wouldn't comment on any speculation. What we really need to do is go through a careful investigation and the Coast Guard.
Those were questions regarding why the tanker had strayed so far outside of the tanker lane.
It will certainly be known. Yes, sir. I-A-R-O-S-S-I. Just say all the vowels and you'll get it right.
I-A-R-O-S-S-I?
Yes.
Tell me this. What would be the normal procedure? Say one of your ships goes out there, they dump 200,000 barrels of oil in the water. What's supposed to happen first? What's supposed to happen second, third, so on?
Well, there's two things that need to go on immediately. One is we need to begin to salvage the vessel, and that's very, very important because it still has a lot of oil on it, and normally it will. So you got to begin to worry. You have to limit the amount of oil that's spilled. That's a very, very important activity. You have a grounding, some oil goes in the water, but normally you will find there's still a significant amount of oil on a ship. So one of your concerns right off the bat is to prevent any further oil from going in the water. That's number one. Number two, you've got to begin to mobilize all the resources to address the oil that is on the water. And those two things need to go on simultaneously. That's not a sequential event. You need to hit them both, and you need to hit them both hard. In the case of the vessel itself, you got to be a little more cautious. The oil on the water, time is critical, so you need to address that just as fast as you can. As far as the vessel goes, time may be critical depending upon the circumstances. The circumstance we have here, I don't think we should be rushing. I think we should be cautious. Because the vessel, as far as we can see and as far as we know, is not leaking any further oil. What happens when you have a bottom rupture like this ship does is a certain amount of oil leaks out until the level of of the oil in the tank is equalized with the water level. And then you basically reach equilibrium and there's nothing further going on as far as oil, as long as you're not disturbing or moving the vessel. So we're in that period now where it will pay for us to be kind of cautious to make sure we have a good damage assessment of the vessel before we go into the lightering operation. But we will need to go into lightering. It's absolutely critical.
It would have done any good, say, at sunup this morning to have like a ton of wings out there trying to grab the oil. That would have...
I really can't comment on that. I know there is considerable boom available right here, so that if, in fact, that seemed to be a reasonable step to take, I'm sure it would have been taken, but I can't comment on what was going on. Alyeska took first response steps. It's between Alyeska and the Coast Guard. Yes, but I think, as far as I know, Alyeska took the response coordination, but I can't swear that. They wouldn't need my permission, no.
If they wanted to be out here until we got here, that's their decision. They might have permission.
I think it's between Alyeska and the Coast Guard. Certainly, the Coast Guard has a responsibility to make sure that everything. That should be done is in fact being done. And they will usually monitor the situation to make sure what they think is reasonably required is in fact going on.
So until you guys get here, it's the responsibility of Coast Guard and Alyeska.
Yes, until we have our response team fully here and ready to go operational, which I think will probably be first light in the morning. But as we stand right now, we're just beginning to get the team together. So as soon as we're ready, we will tell Alyeska and the Coast Guard we're ready to assume operational control. But until we get here, it rests between the Coast Guard and Alyeska. And I think the tendency is to allow, in this case, Alyeska, or whatever is the local cleanup activity, to take first response. And the Coast Guard will have to speak for itself, but I think they usually monitor. If they're not satisfied, then they will take it over.
One last question. Alyeska did a good job so far.
Boy, they sure got me out of bed in a hurry. And I assume that if they got me out of bed as quickly as they did, that they had an awful lot of people scrambling early.
So,
yes, as far as I know. I can't criticize anything I've done.
Sir, you said that the vessel had 5 cargo tanks, clearly damaged, possibly 3 others. How many total cargo tanks?
The vessel has... she has a total of, let me see, 15 tanks, of which 4 are ballast. So she'll have 11 cargo tanks.
With oil
11 cargo tanks that would have been filled at the time she came out. She wasn't actually fully loaded. She can carry 1.5 million barrels. In this trip, she had 1.26 million. The reason she was light was because she was going into San Francisco, so she had to go in with a lighter draft. Right now, the tanks we know that are fully intact are 3 of the cargo tanks and 2 of the ballast tanks. And of course, the engine room is fully intact. So there should be sufficient buoyancy on the vessel as she stands right now. And, you know, there's a lot of tanks damaged, but don't forget, this ship was designed to be full of oil. So, she will operate with the buoyancy that she still has available. We'll float.
We expect you're going to be able to get it off the
reef. Okay, the process we need to go through is we need to get somewhere around 300,000 barrels off the ship, and at that point the ship should float free. And we'll continue to pump oil off the ship until we've got the ship free of cargo. And we'll continue to lightering. So the first step, you know, as long as the vessel is on the reef, she is in a precarious position. So we clearly have to move to get the oil off that ship. We got to do it cautiously, but we got to do that.
You say you're going to pump 300,000 barrels off, and then it'll float, and you can take it away, or you're going to get all the oil off before you...
We're going to start the lightering operation, and the vessel we'll be using has the capability of taking 450,000 barrels off. We think that by time the vessel has transferred about 300,000 barrels by our calculations, she should be light enough to float free. Now at that point it'll depend on the circumstances. We may want to interrupt the lightering to move the vessel and then continue the lightering. But it would be our plan to get all the oil lightered into the other two vessels before we begin to move that ship around.
How long do you expect it to take to get 300,000 barrels of oil off the vessel?
It should be, I'm guessing, about 10 hours, I think, to reach that once we start the lightering. But it depends upon what rates we actually get the pumping up to.
I also have to point out it depends on the weather. And this weather, for this time of year, is very unusual.
Well, that's exactly why we need to take advantage of that calm weather to get the lightering operation going. Pardon? There's 50 feet of water to the port side of the vessel, and that's where we'll be doing the lightering and lightering into the 70,000 tonner, the 75,000 tonner. But 50 feet of water is clearly enough for us to move the 450,000 barrels. She's aground on the starboard side, And it's, from what I understand, it's kind of a ledge, and the pilots have done very careful sounding all around it. On the port side of the vessel, they have a clear 50 feet.
Sir?
Yes, sir.
In nothing has been done so far. We're not requiring hearing the vessel. Fishing industry is a very important industry in this area, and nothing is being done to protect the area of our industry that remains. It's been up since 6:30 this morning, Buck. And there's a large number of boats that are ready to do whatever's necessary, and I'm sure with all advanced technology, the creeks could be protected. And nothing's been done.
Well, clearly, that will be one of our first activities of the shore in the oil spill containment group.
When did that start? We've been begging to go all day. That could have been done this morning without ever nearing the vessel.
I really can't comment on it. I was flying the whole time.
Who did we talk to? The Coast Guard?
Do you think three skimmers is enough to hit a terminal like this?
42-foot skimmers, they hold like 3,000 gallons, and they won't skim nothing. And that's what we got guarding our port.
Well, that's why we need to move quickly on this person.
Well, we've been ready to go since this morning. Why isn't anything being done to protect the creeks? We've been calling and asking to go.
I can't answer.
I like the fact.
Sure.
You said that slip was over 8 miles. You told us here it was 6 miles.
No, I said it covers 6 square miles. That's the latest.
6 square miles?
Yes.
What time did you
go out? Oh, we flew over it at about 5:30 this afternoon.
They were out there early.
I think the Coast Guard has come up with the 6 square miles. I can't measure 6 square miles from 3,000 feet. So I'm using somebody else's figures.